John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent for the morning show on WPR. This hour, we'll take a look at the long and convoluted history of marijuana legalization in the United States with historian Emily Dufton. She's written a book titled Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, which chronicles the fortunes of this herb and the controversy surrounding its legal status. We welcome your participation in the program. Why do you think marijuana legalization has remained such a controversial issue over the last 50 years? Have you personally been active in the fight to legalize marijuana or to make the current laws tougher? Which, with the current push by states to decriminalize marijuana, do you think we are on the path toward full legalization, or do you think that could be derailed? And what questions do you have about the history of marijuana activism in America? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. The email address is ideas@WPR.org. Emily Dufton, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you so much, John. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, early in your book, you write that not since the battle over the federal prohibition of alcohol has a drug pushed so many to take action, and additionally, no other intoxicant in American history has inspired so many people to take to the streets. What is it, do you think, about marijuana that's generated such activism on both sides of the issue?
It really is pretty fascinating, isn't it? There's no other substance that has moved back and forth as often and which has inspired so many people to really take up arms about it, about how they feel about it. And I believe that this is because we've weighted marijuana down with a lot of different meanings, both for people who support extending access to the drug as well as for people who oppose extending access to the drug. For people who support use of the drug, marijuana represents a sense of freedom, of liberty, really, not only from from being free to use it against from the government coming in and saying no, you can't do this, from police intrusion, from things like that, but also access to a drug that many believe is safer than other legal substances like alcohol and tobacco. There is a sense of almost libertarianism around it, that you should be allowed to do what you want in the privacy of your own home as long as you're not harming someone else. For those who are opposed to the drug, there is a very deep sense of fear for public health, for public safety, fear that children could be harmed if they get access to the drug, or fear that cartels can be involved, that you're going to be supporting illegal drug production and trafficking from other countries. So there's these myriad layers of meaning that are placed upon marijuana's use and its very idea of existence within this country as far as people who use it and as far as people who should be prevented or protected from using it.
So federally, marijuana continues to be a banned substance. State laws can and do vary greatly. Can you think of another issue where there's such a divide between federal and state law?
No, and that's really where I see marijuana being remarkably unique. Ever since prohibition was enacted and then repealed, both of those things were done at a constitutional amendment level and have never really been questioned since. The 18th and 21st Amendments were those that enforced prohibition and then repealed it. And they've been in place for, over 80 years. Marijuana is the only drug that has consistently kind of moved back and forth. Even when it was federally outlawed in 1970 with the Controlled Substances Act, Nixon lobbied very hard to have it placed as a Schedule I drug, which meant that federal laws against it would be the most restrictive. But he actually swayed most of the congressional representatives who voted for it by assuring them that its placement was temporary, that marijuana's placement as a Schedule I drug would be temporary pending further investigation. of course, the investigation's results, which came out in 1972 from the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, recommended decriminalization on a national level. And once he received those recommendations, Nixon did nothing. So marijuana remains a federally prohibited drug, although, again, its placement as a Schedule I drug was always ideally supposed to be temporary.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Nixon's Schaefer Commission, because, as you say, Nixon was extremely opposed to marijuana. He had an attorney general who very much agreed with him. And he had someone in the head of this commission, Mr. Schaefer, who would have been considered a pretty safe choice for this. But the Schaefer Commission's report didn't turn out the way the president wanted. In fact, if you read the thing, it could be extremely contemporary in terms of some of the arguments in favor of decriminalizing and legalizing marijuana and saying, okay, there's some real definite problems if we keep on going after people for using this. And some of the things they predicted have, in fact, come to pass. If you think about what's happened legally with marijuana since that time. So what about that report, and how relevant is what it contains to the discussion today?
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I feel like their report could have been released yesterday, and it would sound equally as relevant and timely. A lot of the warnings that the Schaefer Commission produced suggested that America's enforcement of marijuana laws were going to create a greater sense of disrespect and distrust for police officers, for government officials, than they would increase respect for the laws themselves. And you see something similar today, particularly with advocates who really see legalization as a social justice issue. There is a lot of distrust about marijuana laws because most social justice advocates see them as an exemplary form of America's deep racial divide as far as mass incarceration is concerned. 95% of drug arrests occur at the state level. So they see decriminalization or legalization as a way to present a sense of equity and equality as far as the enforcement of marijuana laws are concerned, because although studies have repeatedly shown that blacks and whites use marijuana in equal numbers, it's for the most part African Americans and Latinos who are overwhelmingly targeted and arrested for the drug. Now, this is slightly different in the 1970s because the racial differences in arrest rates weren't as pronounced. But in the 1970s, what the Schaefer Commission realized was happening was that the counterculture was being targeted quite effectively through the enforcement of marijuana laws. These laws were created to tamp down on anti-war protesters, on civil rights protesters, on those involved with the counterculture who really saw marijuana as kind of a symbolic suggestion of what it is that they believed in. They disagreed with the government on numerous counts, particularly on its stance on marijuana, and saw use of the drug or simply involvement with the drug as kind of an additional counter-revolutionary stance. So the idea that the Schaefer Commission would come out in 1972 and say that, well, wait a second, these laws aren't actually creating a safer, more civil society. Instead, they are increasing distrust of the very laws that we're enforcing and the very government that's creating them. You see that in the 1970s relevant to the counterculture, and you see that today relevant to social justice advocates. It's history repeating itself almost exactly with some of the details and some of the larger purposes and motivations of the activists changed.
Your book describes the legal status of marijuana and its reputation as having had three major shifts in recent history. Thus, the subtitle of the book, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Describe those shifts and tell us what happened.
Sure. So marijuana's early history in the United States is fairly well documented, although there's not quite too much known about it. It first came, recreational use first came in about the turn of the 20th century. Prior to that, the drug was known as an effective pain-relieving medication. It was sold in pharmacies, corner pharmacies, in tinctures. It was used to relieve children's teething pain. It was used to relieve cramps. It was used to relieve any kind of nausea, things like that. That was tamped down quite a bit with the Progressive Movement and the Pure Food and Drug Act, which kind of barred this use of substances like that in pharmaceutical manufacturing. But recreational use came primarily through a wave of Mexican migrants coming across the border, escaping the dictatorship of General Porfirio Diaz. From the Southwest, it kind of spread. Of course, it was deeply racialized. For the most part, the government did recognize, or the federal government, I should say, did recognize marijuana use, but racialized it by saying that it was only lower-class whites, African-Americans, and Latinos who were using the drug, and of course, they deeply stigmatized that use. But it began to spread. In the 1930s and 40s, marijuana's cousin hemp, which is the product made from the stalk's fibers, was incredibly important for manufacturing. Particularly during World War II, when most hemp products from the South Pacific were in the hands of the Japanese. So farmers were encouraged to grow the crop to help support the war effort. That, of course, is not the recreational use of the drug, but nonetheless it had the government's support, which is quite fascinating. Then in the 1950s, the drug was starting to be used in urban avant-garde centers like New York and San Francisco. The beat writers were using it, jazz musicians were using it, and it had this sort of ethereal quality that people found very exciting and incredibly useful for the creation of art and music. That, of course, did not stay limited to these urban avant-garde areas in the 1960s when the counterculture sort of bloomed across the country and marijuana use became quite widespread, especially in college campuses. So as the counterculture grew and as marijuana use increased, people started, again, associating the drug with larger ideas of questioning what society was telling them, questioning what the government was telling them. The widespread use of marijuana grew hand in hand with the anti-war movement and with the counterculture. So a lot of counterculture activists who were already questioning the government's line on things like the necessity of the war in Vietnam or the natural nature of segregation, we're also questioning the government's stance on marijuana, which after World War II became very heavy-handed and very opposed. The government was putting out informational tracts that suggested that marijuana would lead immediately to heroin addiction, that it was incredibly dangerous, and counterculture activists saw the government's line about marijuana as a lie, similar to those lies being perpetuated about the war in Vietnam or segregation. So they took the decriminalization or legalization of marijuana as a core purpose to their larger movements for social justice. And through their rather effective campaigns, they were able to push through a dozen statewide decriminalization laws in the 1970s. Between 1973 and 1978, about a third of the country actually ended up living in states where possession of up to an ounce was decriminalized. And this was huge. This was the first wave, the first sort of rise of marijuana and the lowering or de-restriction of marijuana laws. So that was the first rise. But of course, as my book shows, with every revolution in marijuana laws, a counter-revolution forms as well. After the widespread decriminalization of the laws, or decriminalization of marijuana, I should say, there rose up in response an incredibly powerful and incredibly profitable paraphernalia business to cater to all of these people who were living in states where the drug was decriminalized. By 1977, the paraphernalia business was pulling in $250 million a year, which in today's currency would be about $1 billion. It was huge. especially in a time when there were gas lines and the American economy was doing rather poorly, paraphernalia was kind of one bright spot. And because decriminalization is not legalization in that it doesn't quite allow for a sense of regulation and oversight, rates of adolescent marijuana use began to skyrocket, basically, across the country. By 1978, 1979, 9% of high school seniors reported smoking daily, and those, of course, were just the ones responding to surveys. Children as young as 13 reported that the drug was very easy to get, and it became a situation where the paraphernalia industry was also seeming to cater to children. They were producing a lot of items that seemed tailored to kids, bongs shaped like spaceships and frisbees with pipes on them, and all of these other items that looked more like toys than smoking devices. And a wave of parents across the country became incredibly concerned about this. They started finding their young kids smoking pot, and all of the information that they could find about this told them that marijuana use by children was enormously dangerous, that it could render young girls infertile or make young boys grow breasts, and they became terrified by this. So they actually then launched a successive grassroots movement called the Parent Movement, appropriately enough, where they started in Atlanta, Georgia, but it spread nationwide through what was kind of the equivalent of second-wave feminism, a sense of consciousness raising, where parents would come together in their neighborhoods, share information they found about drug use, and kind of collectively collaborate to prevent their children from accessing the drug. They would give them alternative activities to do, and they would essentially kind of shut down drug use in their communities. And this was the beginning of the fall of marijuana. As soon as kids started using it, as soon as paraphernalia companies started tailoring and targeting children with their products, this was setting the stage for a backlash that once the Reagan administration was elected to the White House would become nothing short of a national obsession. So the Parent Movement forms originally in Atlanta in 1976, but by the time Reagan is elected in 1980, it is essentially a national movement. And when First Lady Nancy Reagan is elected, well, not elected, but she ascends to the White House as well, she needs a platform. She's not terribly popular in the beginning of her time in the White House, and she needs something that endears her to the American public. And she finds, basically, heroes in the parent movement, and she takes on the prevention of adolescent child abuse as her primary platform. So even though by the early 1980s, rates of adolescent marijuana use are actually turning static and then dropping, because of the First Lady and her adoption of parent movement tactics, it becomes and remains essentially a national concern. This is where you see the implementation of programs like Just Say No. This is where you see the whole country getting very up in arms about the dangers of drug use. And this is where you see a big flip. It's no longer a concern about an adult's right to do something in the privacy of his or her own home. The concern instead becomes about a child's right to grow up drug-free. So this is the real fall of marijuana. Laws become increased. Decriminalization laws are overturned. And all of a sudden, marijuana's reputation as a drug that means liberty and freedom is replaced by a new reputation where marijuana is essentially a danger and a national scourge.
Emily, I just want to break in because I want to get back to the rise, because we've had the rise and the fall. Now we need to get to the rise, but we also need to get to a break, and then we'll come back and have more of a conversation. And I also want to, when we finish talking about the rest of the well, it's not really an arc, it's more of a sine wave. I also want to talk about what your book really focuses on, which is individual activists and activist groups. We've already heard about some of them. I want to hear about some of their stories, too, when we return. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with more of our discussion of the book Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, written by Emily Dufton, who joins us today on The Morning Show. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about the history of marijuana in the United States. The title of the book under discussion is Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. And we have with us Emily Dufton, who wrote the book. And Emily is a writer and an historian. Emily, just before the break, we were kind of going through the sine wave of marijuana in America, and we caught the first rise and the fall. Just say no, that whole thing. Let's be afraid of marijuana. When did marijuana start to make a comeback? Let's talk about the rise, and then I want to hear more about activists.
Sure. So the second rise, and the one that we're still experiencing right now, actually was born out of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. Even as marijuana was being demonized and condemned on a national level, a few activists, particularly in the San Francisco area, noticed that it really helped a lot of the people who were struggling with the effects of HIV. One of the biggest effects is wasting syndrome, where essentially you waste away. Eating a brownie or smoking some pot actually helped people who were suffering from the disease. It gave them an appetite back. It quelled a lot of their nausea. It quelled some of their pain. And it allowed them to have at least a few more weeks or months of a satisfactory sense of life before succumbing, unfortunately, to the disease. So that was the reason why California passed the first medical marijuana law in 1996. It was very much so born out of activists who were supporting and really trying to aid those who were suffering from HIV/AIDS. But that was huge, right? That really set the precedent of transforming marijuana's reputation from a national plague to not quite a panacea, but something that could help people, because not only did it help people suffering from HIV/AIDS, but others started using it as well. People suffering from glaucoma, people who were going through chemotherapy because they had cancer, people suffering from stomach problems. Marijuana became seen as a substance that actually had a lot of medical utility. Again, something that the government does not recognize because it remains a Schedule I drug. But then in 2010, a woman named Michelle Alexander, who is a law professor at Ohio State University, published a book called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, where she essentially argues that through America's punitive system of laws, particularly its drug laws for nonviolent offenders, we have incarcerated a larger percentage of our black population than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. It was an incredibly powerful book that made incredibly well-researched and well-reasoned arguments, and it launched a movement for social justice within the realm of mass incarceration that is really quite unprecedented. Now, Michelle Alexander doesn't discuss legalization. She doesn't really discuss marijuana that much, and I think she only mentions decriminalization once. But activists saw her argument and saw her belief that people should begin to really work for a sense of racial equality in the American justice system and took it to this idea of changing marijuana laws. Marijuana does account for the majority of nonviolent drug arrests, and people saw the racial divisions of who was being arrested for a drug that's used in fairly equal numbers across the country and said, this is one place where we can make a concrete change. So through America's now 21, almost 22-year history of recognizing marijuana's efficacy as medical drug, and now through its five-year, almost six-year history as a recreational substance, one that ideally, although in practice hasn't quite answered our questions and resolved some of our issues with social justice, that has created the conditions for its subsequent rise and increasing support for the legalization of marijuana on both medical and recreational levels.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the discussion about marijuana on the Ideas Network this morning with Emily Dufton, author of the book Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Much of your book focuses on those individual activists and activist groups that you've referred to so far. Why was it so important to you to tell their stories?
I was really fascinated by the people. When I started graduate school, this book was born out of my dissertation, I was really interested in studying activism, American activism. And activism only occurs because of people. Excuse me. So I wanted to go in and find a way to study American activism in a way that hadn't been done before. And really, it was through the stories of the people who were most touched and most inspired by working for this drug that I found that story. Even people who were only involved in movements for a short while remained passionate about it. I was able to conduct over 24 interviews with individuals, and they had memories from the 1970s and 80s as though it happened yesterday. And talking to these people who made these changes happen on state and federal levels convinced me that marijuana laws don't change on these higher levels because of the actions of governors or presidents or first ladies. They happen because a spark was ignited at that grassroots level, because individual people started to care. Something made them concerned or something made them inspired, and they took to the streets. And because of their actions and because of their commitment, laws have changed across the country over and over and over again. I thought they were just such fascinating individuals that I needed to tell their stories.
We've had a number of callers who have come and gone, weren't able to stay on. Todd is one of them in Crawford County, but he wanted to ask, is your guest familiar with the event Weedstock? He was one of the original organizers of the event when it started in Wisconsin as a fundraiser for the group Normal, who ultimately took the event national. What do you know about Weedstock? And that actually introduces something I wanted to talk about a little bit, which is that group called Normal. But were you familiar with Weedstock?
I am a little bit familiar with Weedstock, yes, and I know it has Wisconsin origins, which was really exciting to be on this show today. But as far as Normal is concerned, yeah, what else can I tell you about them?
Well, there was a significant incident, a story you recount in your book about a Christmas party during the Carter administration, which became a real pivotal moment in the history of marijuana in the United States. Just briefly talk about that, and then I want to hear about Lowell Eggemeyer.
Sure, yeah. So it's interesting, actually. Someone on Twitter reminded me that December 10th, 1978, was the anniversary. So it was just a couple days ago that this Christmas party occurred, not quite 40 years ago. So what happened was when Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976, he ran on a platform of basic support for state-based decriminalization laws. He kind of said, I won't stand in the way. And one of the reasons he did this was because he had a drug advisor whose name was Peter Bourne, who was very concerned about the widespread heroin epidemic of the time. And he said, marijuana is not something we need to be concerned about. We need to treat these people who are overdosing and dying from heroin. Carter trusted Bourne. He was a very trusted advisor for him. It helped him through his presidential run, and said, okay. Bourne ends up becoming probably one of the most one of the closest relationships of Keith Straub, who is the founder of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, which is also based in D.C. So Keith Straub every year would host a Christmas party, a big Christmas party in D.C., and he invited Keith Straub to come in 1978. Straub and Bourne were already kind of on the outs because Straub was really opposed to Bourne's support for the Mexican government using an herbicide called Paraquat on their illegal marijuana fields, but they didn't want to seem like they were having a tiff. So Bourne agrees to go. Now, this is kind of where the story splits. some people say that they then witnessed Peter Bourne do a couple lines of cocaine at this party. Not all eyewitnesses agree to that. Peter Bourne has repeatedly said that he did not do those things. But Straub was angry at Bourne and leaked to the press that, you know, Carter's chief drug advisor is using legal drugs at Normal's Christmas party, which destroys Bourne's reputation, renders him essentially obsolete within the administration, in addition to an additional scandal that he got himself into that summer. And he is kicked out of the White House. He essentially has to resign in disgrace. And that sounds the death knell for decriminalization in the United States, at least in the 1970s. Carter can't touch the topic with the 10-foot pole. It tarnishes his reputation quite a bit, and it basically paves the way for the rise of the parent movement as well and for growing distrust of the effects of decriminalization in the country.
The tell us about Lowell Eggemeyer, the nation's first grassroots marijuana activist. What kind of movement did he kick off?
He's a fascinating guy. He was just a regular dude. He's a 28-year-old Californian, and he, in 1964, walks into the San Francisco Police Department, lights up a joint, and says, I am starting a protest to legalize marijuana in the United States, and I'd like to be arrested, which is a really gutsy move because marijuana was a felony at the time in that state. So he immediately gets hauled off to jail, and he serves a year in confinement. There's not too much known about him. I was able to get in touch with him and talk to him briefly, but he's not interested in being committed to the movement that formed in his name anymore. He was a really quiet, easygoing guy and not really a member of what became known as the hippie movement that really coalesced a couple of years later in that same city. But what happened was he had a lawyer named James White who defended him pro bono. James White was very much so a libertarian who really disagreed with any kind of law enforcement that would impinge on a person's personal dignity and freedom. And he dug up all of these old documents, federal documents from the 1800s on, which discussed marijuana use and basically said, you know, it's not that big of a deal. He reprints and publishes these and starts spreading them around San Francisco, saying, hey, you know, the government's coming down pretty hard on marijuana right now, but it wasn't always so. And if it wasn't always so, how can we go back to that time where we recognize marijuana's lack of harm as opposed to other substances like tobacco and alcohol? And that launches essentially what becomes the first movement for decriminalization and legalization in the United States. Is all because of one guy who no longer wants to be associated with the movement that formed in his name.
Oh, wow. And that's interesting. There are just so many fascinating stories in this book. We'd need hours to cover all of them. And if we told all the stories, that would not encourage book sales. let's take a phone call. We'll go to Cooteray and hear from Daryl. Daryl, good morning. Thanks for being with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. I had just a couple comments. I believe the question of marijuana will be answered in Wisconsin soon. I think the activism against marijuana is the fact that under its influence, one becomes relaxed, and that is the main reason to use it. But in addition, it also affects our inherent need to question our surroundings, so we notice more and learn more of our environment, both private and public. The powers that be, I feel, do not want us to question anything. Just go to work and pay taxes. Also, if there really was a war on drugs, they would put the drugs in jail and let the people go free, you would think.
Mm-hmm. Daryl, thanks so much for the call. Emily Dufton, anything you want to respond to there?
Oh, I love the comment about putting the drugs in jail and letting the people go free. I think that's really clever. But I think Those are some really interesting points, and it feels very similar to the arguments that were being made in favor of decriminalization in the 1970s. That sense of questioning, that sense of not towing the line, has been a part of marijuana activism now for decades and decades. It's an inherent part of it, and that is, I think, part of what really inspires people to take up the cause.
Daryl, thanks for the call. Let's go to Larry in Kingston next. Larry, hello.
Hi. The police raided my house for marijuana. I ended up with a possession charge. And they came in with full riot gears, their faces covered, bulletproof vests, M4s. They ripped up my house. Did thousands of dollars in damage, and I think for such a peaceful drug, people that do marijuana don't hurt people, and I think it's an easy crime for the police to and the government to create money for their law systems and that. And if they were really serious, they'd legalize marijuana. And then people that buy marijuana on the street wouldn't have connections for cocaine and heroin.
All right, Larry, thanks. The point about if we legalize it, that actually would reduce perhaps the use of other illegal substances. Has that actually been the case in Colorado, for example, and some of the other states where we've seen decriminalization or the legalization of recreational marijuana? I mean, I've seen some reports that seem to suggest that that opioids are used a lot less in those areas where marijuana is legal.
Yes, absolutely. That's a very big talking point right now. As far as conversations about legalization are concerned, the rate of opioid prescriptions in legalized states have dropped distinctly. I think about 1,800 fewer prescriptions per year in states where people have access to either recreational or medical marijuana. And there is an argument as well for recreational legalization decreasing access to other illegal substances, because essentially if you're no longer shopping on the black market, you don't have access to those other substances. Those are more difficult studies to complete, of course, because, you know, it's very difficult to survey people on illegal activities and things like that. But it has become rather clear that people who turn to legal sources of marijuana to treat things like pain do not use the same level of prescription opioids and then subsequently black market opioids as well.
It interestingly enough, one of the major opponents of recreational marijuana in the state of Arizona in a referendum in 2016 was a big pharmaceutical company whose main business is selling opioid pain relievers. So there could be a source of some of the opposition to legalization. Those who are currently making money on opioids aren't going to want to see something come down the line that makes their business model untenable.
Absolutely. That is actually one of the most viable financial forms of opposition to legalization. There is a lot of money coming from major pharmaceutical manufacturers lobbying legislators to avoid or oppose legalization. That is probably, if not the largest source of funding, certainly one of the largest sources of funding. Because, of course, you know, pharmaceutical manufacturers don't want to lose their bottom line. And if marijuana cuts in on that, that's they need to preserve their business model. That's a big complication as far as legalization efforts are currently concerned.
Okay. We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, I want to hear about some other individual activists who are worth mentioning that we haven't talked about yet, and we have more callers, so a lot to do in the next 10 minutes or so. We're talking about the history of marijuana in the United States, the The book under discussion, Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America. Historian Emily Dufton is with us. She's the author of the book, and we'll be here for about another 10 minutes taking your calls, if we can get them in, and finding out more about this fascinating topic. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show today. We're talking about the book Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, with its author, Emily Dufton, a writer and historian. Emily, we've got a bunch of calls here. I'd like to get to one, and then I'd like to actually shift gears a little bit and talk about the future of marijuana policy and where it's going and where it could face some setbacks. We already mentioned kind of one, which is the opposition of major pharmaceutical companies, but there's probably some others out there. And I want to hear at least one more story about an activist. Let's go to John in Green Bay. John, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, good morning. You guys mentioned earlier that very early in the program, it's getting opposition because people are afraid that kids will have easier access if it's legalized. Now, I used to be a dealer. John is not my real name. I'm not going to give you my real name. But I can tell you that what I would sell to anybody with money, teenagers made up maybe 10% of my business, but I'd sell to them. It's illegal to sell to grandma, it's illegal to sell to them. But if you were to legalize the stuff and I had a licensed dispensary, I can guarantee you I would not risk my license for the 10% of my business that's kids. So making it easier for kids to get by legalizing it, that's a joke. You're going to make it harder because the dealers are going to go out of business.
All right, John, thanks for that perspective. Emily Dufton, is that one of the arguments in favor of legalizing marijuana, that we can actually more effectively keep it out of the hands of people who shouldn't be using it?
Yes, actually, I think that's a great point. What he's saying is entirely true, and you do see that enacted in states that have legalization measures so far. A licensed dispensary is usually guarded by a bouncer, essentially, who is checking IDs before you're able to enter the store. They're heavily guarded, they're heavily regulated, and they're heavily monitored. So it's true. You can't have like a kid wander into this store because there are levels of security, in fact, multiple levels of security on these licensed stores, and these owners don't want to risk their license. And you also see in legalized states, rates of adolescent marijuana use either remaining stagnant or even dropping slightly because of A, the effects of how difficult it is to get into the store, B, the multiple levels of taxation that make legal marijuana so much more expensive than that on the black market, and C, kind of a changing sense of reputation. Those who can afford legal marijuana are generally older, and I think kids see, like, wait a second, if, like, my parents or grandparents are smoking, it's not cool anymore. It's not transgressive anymore. So you actually do see legalization resulting in slightly lowered rates of adolescent use.
Oh, man, that's interesting. At the moment, it kind of feels like we're on the fast track to widespread legalization in this country. Eight states plus Washington, D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana. Other states passed pro-pot referenda in 2016. Is it just a matter of time until the rest of the dominoes fall? And other than a major opposition from well-financed people who have a lot to lose if marijuana becomes legal, what else could derail the push for legal pot?
Well, I am not quite ready to agree with the idea that it is, you know, that the road to full and national legalization is clear. I see a lot of potholes ahead, actually. Not only, of course, from very well-financed opposition from pharmaceutical manufacturers, but from the various problems that arise from having a difference between state laws and federal laws. You've already seen something like this happen, for example, in Maine, where a ballot initiative was approved in 2016 to legalize the recreational use of the drug, but Governor LePage has vetoed the measure. He is very opposed to marijuana use, very opposed to legalization, and is simply not allowing it to happen in the state. Ballot initiatives are the way that all legalization measures have been passed so far, and those are only available in about half of the states, so that limits the passage of these laws as well. And in addition to the fact that because marijuana remains federally illegal, no matter what happens, there's still that boundary to overcome, and this makes it very difficult for marijuana growers to ensure their crops. So if something happens like the wildfires in Northern California, growers can lose out on millions of dollars and they cannot have their crop insured. Well, so it's a very dangerous proposition.
And they don't have access to banks.
Exactly. They don't have access to banks. They can't traffic the drug interstate. So you have to kind of limit how much you grow because you're scared of flooding the market within the legal state. There's a lot of problems still. So I don't see the path forward being completely clear yet.
So the story of marijuana in America is far from over. The Department of Justice, you mentioned that this disparity between state and federal law. The Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Sessions, recently hinted that it may take a tougher stance on recreational marijuana in the near future. Could the Department of Justice shut down legal marijuana operations in states that have already legalized it?
They could. What happened over during the Obama administration when the first legalization laws were being passed was something called the Cole Memo, written by an assistant attorney general whose last name was Cole, appropriately enough. He essentially said that the federal government would allow state laws to take place and continue, assuming that states didn't completely ignore federal laws. They wouldn't grow on federal lands, they wouldn't sell to children, things like that. Now, the memo is only a memo. It's not law. So the DOJ under the Trump administration and under Attorney General Sessions' leadership has no need necessity to follow through with it, and they can create their own system of laws. Sessions has not only threatened to kind of come down hard on state legalization laws, but if the Rohrabacher-Blumenauer amendment also is not continued, there is another threat actually to state medical marijuana laws. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen on the federal level either. There's a lot of things that are under question at the moment.
Finally, in about 30 seconds or so, at the end of the book you talk about some lessons from the past that activists can consider in the future. Give us one suggestion that you would have for activists on the marijuana issue.
I think the strongest lesson that I learned was that you really do have to respect your opposition and take their fears or their hopes seriously. This needs to be a discussion about the role that this drug plays in American life, as opposed to simply a battle where we close off our ears and don't listen to anyone else. Because the more we respect those who don't necessarily agree with us, I think the more easily we can come to a collaborative agreement about how we can move forward with this drug in the most healthy, sustainable way.
All right. Emily Dufton, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Emily Dufton is a writer and historian. She is the author of Grassroots, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Marijuana in America, published by Basic Books. This hour of the morning show was produced by Chris Molina and Bill Martins. Michelle Johnson is the executive producer. We also had help today from Cheryl Gasser. It really does take a village to make a talk show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Stay tuned. Coming up after the news on the Ideas Network, it's On Point.